Today is Tuesday, May 30th, 2023. This is part 9 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. Scott spells his last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
Yeah, good. Nice to get your call and continue on with this history of my life in the Grand Canyon and river running, I guess.
Yeah, thank you so much. Scott, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you. Last time you were telling us about some early, kind of mid-1970s things that you recalled from your Grand Canyon days. Could you kind of pick up with those recollections?
Yeah, sure. I was... This would have been an M&A trip, Museum Northern Arizona research trip, and we were down in the canyon, you know, for a number of months doing the research for the park and whatever purposes, and then I also needed boatmen that were with the biology group that were always in the canyon with me on these rowing trips, doing their investigations for plants, fish, bugs, sandbars, all this kind of stuff. And so one of the fellows, Stuart Aitchison, I was thinking he might work out as a rower, and he had a little ducky that he brought down, and it was it wasn't big enough to be a Grand Canyon boat, but he was game to run it, and I was game to like pick him up when I needed to grab him out of the water or whatever. Hmm. But we came into Crystal, and I hadn't thought about how he was rigging his boat. I was just giving him gear to take, but everything went on the floor of his boat, and we went through Crystal, and I believe he went, which is normal and natural, unfortunately, is that you get swept over to the Rock Island. And that Rock Island gutted the bottom of this very flimsy boat. It slid it, and we lost everything that was on that floor, and so that would have been all the pots and pans, food, this and that, and so we lost all that stuff, and that was a drag. I could care less if the boat was gone, and we probably had to pick him up. The boat was probably not quite sinking, but we picked him up, but we lost all that gear.
Mm.
But we lucked out with M&A. It was lucky that Steve Carruthers, who ran all this, I was a lead boatman on everything, outfitting everything, but he was in charge of the money and what we should do.
Okay.
And so we always had flyovers. Steve would ask me, when do you think it's a good time to have a flyover to see how we're doing? And this would have been a Park Service plane that flew over, and which I never had the comfort of having any kind of phones or anything like that down in the canyon,
right,
for emergency communications. But with the park and the grant and, you know, what we were doing, we got pretty good service from the Park Service. We had good radios that could communicate with a flyover plane.
Okay.
So we had different days or days that I would go, oh, you know, if we're going to run Crystal on that day, why don't we have a flyover then? We'll do a flyover at Lava. We'll do a flyover at anything else that I think. So we just happened to have had a flyover, and here we lost all this gear. And the point of all this, pretty much, is just how tightly we worked with the Park Service, and what a great thing and support we had. Because nobody had radios that work on any commercial trips. So if it was just a normal commercial trip, having lost everything, we would have been asking commercial groups, "Do you have any spare pots and pans? Do you
right.
have any spare this or that?" And I have done that when certain things happen, but it was nice that we had a flyover, and we could call in, hey, we just lost this and this and this and this, and we're going to go camp down at Shinamu Camp on the right side. Could you go and gather together up at the top of South Rim, pots and pans, some this and that kind of condiments, and we still had two or three boats that still had food and stuff, but we lost a major cooking system. So, and that was great. What a windfall. The point of this story was...
How did they get that stuff to you, though? You can't just, drop something out of a plane and expect a pot to survive.
True. But we picked a campsite, which was at Shinemu's site, and the helicopter came in at a certain planned time.
Okay.
And we said, okay, we'll be down there, and we'll be waiting for you, and we picked that. I picked that because I thought that there was a spot to land a helicopter. It was kind of a big camp at that time at Shinemu, just above the creek. Mm-hmm. So the helicopter came in on time and brought some beer with him, and we started a fire probably and looked at all the stuff that was brought and what we got what we still needed or whatever, but it was enough to manage and carry on. But the pilot landed it, and we unloaded everything, and we visited and drank some beer together and thanked him for helping us out. And at his time, he said, well, I better get back up to the top. So good luck. Enjoy your trip, and happy to help you. So off he flew, and
how about that?
We had all this gear that was like, wow, now when you can have that kind of power down in the Grand Canyon and call in the Park Service and say, hey, we need a helicopter to fly this down to us. We've got a number of days and miles to go. So, they did that. And that was
cool.
That was really sweet. It kind of gave me a sense of like, gosh, we've got so much backup force for our trips. It's pretty comfortable to have that. So
yeah. Hey, there was a cable there for the mm-hmm. Bass Tramway that was
right
cut down right about that time.
That's right. Yeah.
Were you on the trip that cut that down, or do you remember that? No. Okay.
Yeah. I did not have anything with cutting that down, but I just remember going under it for the first months and months of my tour down in Grand Canyon. I remember that, and camping at Bass Camp and seeing where it was anchored on shore and some wreckage of the unit that was going back and forth with Bass, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, but it was gone. It was there for quite some time. It was kind of sad to see it go because it was like, wow, this is still a piece of history down here, and it's... And it felt like we had to duck to get under it sometimes with higher water.
Hmm.
I do believe that was the case at times. Not a scary level, but it was when the river would get pretty high, that sagging cable was still, here we go, Everybody ducked down, but it wasn't that close, but it was kind of a funny feeling going under this big cable.
Huh.
But yeah, that was there. And that, as far as interesting things, I'm going to leap over to this. This is just another story, and it has to do with the Bat Cave down farther.
Okay.
And as a part of a prehistoric thing that was still left down there, the Bat Cave, we always wondered, Steve and I, Carruthers, always wondered, I'd never stopped on a commercial trip, but here we're with the M&A, and we could do and go and do whatever we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And we made time for whatever was necessary, whether we wanted more time, to go all the way up Havasu to see the Indians up there or do whatever we wanted to do. So I go, we should stop at the Bat Caves and go up and see what the heck that's all about. And I don't think it officially was out of the border of what we could do, but it didn't matter. It was kind of like we had carte blanche down there to go and investigate whatever we wanted, which the bats, see if bats were up there, and we were studying bats as well as anything. So we parked there one mid-afternoon and walked up to the cave and saw tracks for carts to be wheeled out of there and old rubble from what they used, the machinery they used. And we got in the cave, and there was a I don't know why, but there was a lot of construction that was set up inside to get the carts and the guano out deep in that cave. And we were able to, that wood was still walkable, and there's guano everywhere, thick in that, and it smelled, and it was gooey, and we were slogging in this. It was slippery too, and we had flashlights, but you know, it was, you could slip and fall because it was so slimy, but we were able to stay on this wood walkway, if that's what it was for the miners, I don't know, but it was good to have that. And we finally ran out of that as we got deeper and deeper into the cave. And then I believe it started to branch off, and we were pretty far deep into it. And I think we decided we had gone far enough, and we were slimy enough with bat guano. And I didn't want to, I don't think Steve or I wanted our flashlights to die back in there. And we'd gone pretty far, and it seemed like now would be a good time to get out of there. So then we came out, and it was, while we were in there, we also flushed thousands, it felt like thousands and thousands of bats. When we came in that cave, we disrupted their sleep, right. And I guess is what happened. And man, it was like we had just taken a bat to a beehive, and they were pissed. And all these bats, they weren't mad at us, but they all, thousands of them, headed out at us over our heads, and we ducked down to keep away from them. And it was just a real experience being in that thing. Wow. And so we finally got to the opening, and it's all boulder hopping all the way up the cliffs to get to that. It's, you know, no trail or anything. So we launched ourselves out of the cave and headed down, and we couldn't wait to get to the Colorado and get all this guano off of us and bathe. And we were just dark brown, oily, and stinky from all that guano that we went through. But yeah, that's just another little thing about historic stuff.
Hey, Scott, let me ask you about the access to the cave. There's a big Eureka vacuum bag in a giant drum sitting on a big tower, and they had this big motor that would make a vacuum, and they would suck up the guano in this tube, and the tube would go into this kind of cyclone big canister from Eureka Vacuum Company, and it would collect the bat guano, and then they had an aerial tramway to get it out of there. So you could get up to that tower, but then there was a short cliff, and above that short cliff there was a long ramp that went up to the mouth of the cave, and there was a wooden slide in that ramp, and there was a lot of batshit had been dribbled down that slope side, and it was kind of not super rocky there, kind of covered in bat poop. Do you remember there was a tower, like a radio tower, that was placed so you could climb up to get up that cliff? But that was later, when you were there in the 70s, how did you get up? Was there a ladder there that you climbed up? How did you get through that cliff?
I don't recollect when we got to the mouth of the cave. What you're talking about, from all the numerous flyovers that I did, that tower was on the other side of the river, what I recollect. And it was what you're talking about, it was cabled from the cave, brought out with carts is what I remember. It seemed like they brought it out with carts. And somehow those carts took the cables over to where that tower was.
Okay, so there were two towers on the south side of the river, one at the winch house at the very top, and then there was one standalone tower all by itself, and those are still there. And then there was a long free span of cable that went down to this other tower, and then there was a side tower off to the side, and this is on River Wright, that was a counterweight that as this the car went up and down this cable. The cable would go up and down, and they had quite the complex way of sorting that out. But then getting from that area where the tower was, again, it's the base of this cliff, up to the actual mouth of the cave. I just wondered if you remembered that. If you don't, that's no worries. So.
Yeah, no. What I've said is what I recollect.
Okay,
and
great.
And because of the flyovers, and maybe just deadheading out on trips, I might have noticed up on the South Shore mountaintops there.
Sure.
I would have seen that.
Sure.
But for us, the key was to go where the source of the guano was and see what the heck went on in that place.
Right.
And,
right.
And that's kind of what I recollect. I don't recollect anything difficult other than we had, we got to walk on the bridge kind of construction that was inside.
The boardwalk's in there, yeah.
Yeah, the boardwalk in there. Have you been in that thing?
Yes.
Have you gone? You have?
But it was, the number of times that I've been there, it got more and more difficult to get in there. And now that whole thing's gone now. There was a pipe there. You had to kind of work your way up the pipe to get up that low cliff. It's just getting harder and harder to, that's what it is. So, But what's interesting is you actually had thousands and thousands of bats in there when you were there, and there were none when we were there. So I was just like, maybe it was a different time of year. And maybe there's something else happening in the bat population. So I'm just not sure.
I don't know, but I wasn't surprised. We were going into the den of them, their home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but I was really surprised at the volume and the squeaking. They make a squeaking sound, an eek, 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 and the noise from them crying, that sound as they fluttered out. It wasn't quite like a black cloud, but it was dark, and their noises were, that was phenomenal. It was a great opportunity to be in something historic like that. And my God, this is why there's guano. This doesn't stop. They're flooding out at us and heading out the mouth of the cave, and off they went.
Wow.
But talk about bats, man. If somebody wanted to study bats, there was, I don't know if there were millions, but there were probably hundreds of thousands of them. So I wanted to just, I had forgotten kind of about that, but that's kind of just another thing of that period that was available to me. Let's see.
And then you were doing some work with M&A with some geologists out in the Western Grand Canyon. Can you cover that?
Yeah, that's something. Jim Sears and I had told you about the Billingsley. I think Jim might have been on this trip too. And they are all geologists that were working on the mapping of Western Grand Canyon. And I had mentioned that how could there be any place in Grand Canyon that hadn't been mapped, studied, whatever. And so I go, there's got to be maps. And that's when I went to look at a Grand Canyon map. And I mentioned this before, is like there was a note on the map saying something to the effect that this area is yet to be discovered and mapped or something like that. It was like, gosh, this is all, Lake Mead's on the left side and Parashant and all this other stuff's on the other side, and they don't even know anything about it, And so here we were mapping Billingsley and Jim Sears and a few other geologists. And you mentioned the NAU fellow.
Stan Buse.
Yeah, Stan Buse, a part of this, but never on any of our trips out to verify stuff.
Okay.
We were talking about Parashant, and before that was 209 and breaking down our vehicle. Well, we took that vehicle, Jim Sears and I, out to a Parashant canyon, the top of it, and we went we had to go down creek beds, which, again, we're out in the middle of freaking nowhere, and we're using dead reckoning to kind of get to where we're going and we need to go with, maps that had the volcanic stuff or lava and all that, just reading our way to find these places. And here we are. Jim says, okay, now we got to go. We're going to turn here, and we got to drop into this creek channel that's dry, but it was been cut by flooding at some point in its life in the million years. He says, yeah, we got to go down this to get to the mining camp. I go, really? We're going to go down this thing. And then there were boulders, and there were drop-offs, waterfall drop-offs, dry, but we would clunk the carry-all down these little drop-offs, which would have been waterfalls if there was rain, but it was like one after another taking this funky car again, going, we are so far out of nowhere that it's hot, and we're never going to, if this thing breaks down, man, we're going to have a tough time getting out. But we made it down to the bottom, and there was a miner's cabin there, and that was where we staged ourselves for the few days that we stayed out there.
Okay.
This old miner's cabin. And then around the corner from the miner's cabin was where he had stashed all of his bags of what he had found. I don't know how the miners do that stuff, but there were bags and bags of fine rocks, like they'd been pounded or they'd, and I don't know how he got them, but it was probably a vein that he was going after, and he was going to haul those out and have them checked to see what kind of material might have been in them. As he, that was, it was quite deep, a little cave that he had blasted and hammered, I guess, out, and that's where he had all this stuff. He'd hidden it in there, and we found it, and it just turned out to be bags and bags and bags of minerals that he had pulled out of a vein somewhere.
Huh.
But that's where we, that's, and there was a runway there for an airplane, not at the cabin site, but not far from it, out on a flat of all that rock. There was where a plane could land, and it wasn't like it had been used, but out in the middle of absolutely nowhere, top of Parashant Canyon, and here is an airstrip, and it's probably, I'm sure it's still there, it's probably not used, but it looked to me like when we were exploring outside of the cabin and all over the area up there, to come across this airstrip, that was pretty cool. And so we've got a miner's cabin, we've got an airstrip, we've got material that he saved, and that was the beginning of our hike down Parashant. And Jim had ideas. I talked about the stereoscopic exploration from these photos as to where we should look and confirm certain sites had these kind of rocks, or there was a some sort of a break in a canyon wall that had certain geographic issues going on that we needed to make sure by hiking into all these areas to confirm that what we saw in the stereoscopic stuff was actually for real. And that's how all that mapping done of Western Grand Canyon was. A lot of it was done air flights, stereoscopically, and then proving it. And that's what Billingsley and Jim Sears and others would hike and explore all this stuff and
okay.
confirm it. And I was on that duty kind of, and Jim Sears and I headed down Parashant and would take Brunton compasses and measure the angles of these, the faults and how much and what direction they had faulted. And also something to do with the magnetic, there was something that was very interesting. I won't describe it probably as good as it should be, but the iron in this rock, he would note the direction it was extracted, and that would the changing of the poles and all that throughout historic time, the mystery kind of like, why did South and North poles, why did they flip-flop? And you may be familiar with that, but that's one thing we're also checking was which way did the iron that was in the rock get oriented, which at one
right.
time would have been probably in liquid mud or whatever. And so we also did that. We mapped and took notes about where that where the direction of the iron went in the rock. But we hit it on down, and this gets back to finding one more miner's camp. And we got to a point where we could, at some point, we could look down and see the Colorado. And before we got to that area, we came to another miner's camp. And that's where we, of course, were surprised that out in the middle, away from the cabin and everything, that
right.
this place was set up. And we started pawing around and looking at stuff, and there were old 50-gallon drums or, you know, 25-gallon drums
mm-hmm.
for gear or whatever. And then we're very nosy about finding a kind of undisturbed miners' camp and what fun stuff we might come upon. And underneath ledges on some walls, we found boxes. And they were boxes. We opened them up, and they were boxes of dynamite. And they were kind of placed under a ledge, and mining was going on there. And we both said, you know, if there is dynamite here, there's going to be the coil of what do you call that? What the rope that goes up to the dynamite?
Like a fuse.
Yeah, it was the caps, and there was like rolls of
or det cord. You mean?
It was
detonation cord is another way of setting off dynamite.
Yeah.
You need electric. Well, you need a fuse and a cap to get something going.
Yeah, and that's what we discovered, is that if there is coils and coils of this fuse, mm-hmm. there's got to be caps here somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so that led us onto more ledges, and where we would find some cooking stuff was there. And this was all really old, all really rusted, just classic. We came upon a miraculous little windfall of stuff.
Cool.
And so we looked at the, we found the caps, and they were all in little cardboard boxes, I guess, on these ledges.
Yep.
And we found the caps, we'd found the fuse, and we'd found the dynamite, and we lit a fuse to see if it worked still, and it worked fantastic. You know, we could make a 50-yard long fuse if we wanted to. And so we took, we thought it might be entertaining. I had never blown up dynamite before. Heavy fireworks, yes, but nothing like dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, you know, we should see what happens here. So we took the caps and the fuses and sticks of dynamite, and out of just from watching Western movies, I guess we figured out you got to stick the cap on the end of the fuses, and that's got to go into the end of the dynamite. And then we got to get enough line out so that we can light it and get out of the way and hide somewhere. And that's what we did. And we found, we used one of those 50-gallon drums, or a little less than that. They might not have been quite 50-gallon drums, but we found one of those. We said, well, you know what we ought to do is, once we've got the dynamite and the cord and everything set up, let's put that huge gallon drum on top of it and see what happens. So being kids that were inquisitive, we did all that, and then we lit the fuse, and we went and hid behind some boulders just to get all the protection we could, because we knew not what was going to happen. But when it went off, it was like it was brand new dynamite, and it blew loud. It echoed in the canyon like unbelievable. And the lid, the bottom of that drum, we could crawl out from our hiding place and watch it, and it went so high. It just went forever and ever, ever up into the sky. And the whole experience was just blew our minds that we had found this, the mining camp. We'd found all this other stuff that had been left, and it had to have to do with where probably we were spending our nights in that cabin, which was old. But anyway,
cool.
That was interesting, although highly illegal, but I don't know. We did it.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty neat. Echoes like you've never heard down in the canyon.
Huh.
The walls just reverberated. It was, everything about that was beautiful in the respect of just the mammoth depths the Grand Canyon is, and what the walls can do. And, it's incredible. And all the mining that was going on, and the holes in the caves that were dug up and blown up. So anyway, I'm just going to link both of those little stories with the bats and my friend losing all the gear, and then all the geology we investigated. And so that's that for that.
Cool.
So I'm looking at my notes right now, and if you have an idea.
Yeah, there was a spring at 214 Mile
mentioned. Yeah, that's a good one, yeah. Yeah, 214, it's pretty close to where you can have your last night and have a short run out to get to Diamond Creek.
Uh-huh.
So, I had mentioned that I'd always seen a spring there, and there was also another part up higher up in the canyon within your third or fourth day in the canyon that had a cottonwood way up high, and I never got to go to that, and it finally died and fell over. But this spring by that camp was, a fair ways up on the canyon wall, all the talus slope and all that. And I took the time after we got camped there, and I go, I'm going to go up there. And I hiked all the way up there to it. And it was just a little oasis of water and plants and vegetation and birds. And it wasn't much bigger than like a card table, really. The water there was a little pond, a tiny little pond of fresh water. I drank some of that. It was spring water, and the bottom of it was enough that it didn't drain out. It stayed a little pond right in there. Hmm. And the birds used it, bugs used it, and it was so cute. After wondering about it, after all these trips and being there, seeing just how calm, peaceful it was way up on this mountainside. And so I kind of laid down and rested there. And I ended up, I fell asleep right after I had seen a pink rattlesnake as I was, watching the birds and the animal, not, big animals come in there, but anyway, who was using this little tiny pond? And so I was getting sleepy, and a pink rattler had come up to the edge of the pond. And for some reason, at that time, I was tired. It was the end of the day, and we'd been rowing and fighting wind probably to get down to that campsite. And I'd hiked up to this spot, and I was tired. So I kind of laid down, and that rattlesnake had come. And it kind of just settled down there, too, maybe 4 feet from me. And I don't know, it was so amazing, the comfort of being by this little tiny pond, which was so important to all these little tiny animals that knew it was there. And here this rattlesnake came from frickin' out of nowhere and got up by the water and coiled up and sat there. And I was just getting ready to take a nap and fall asleep. And it was almost like, if you were a part of some of God's saints that were protecting animals or whatever, I was there in the bliss of we're all in this together, and we can all take care of one another. Kind of, it was an awesome feeling to be with this rattlesnake that had no harm in its mind. And I was like, I could have gone and petted it. The way it felt to me, it was like, God, I can't believe this. I am at one with these animals. And this water is like the reason for life right here. So anyway, I wanted to just, not many people were able or are able, if it's even still there, but to have, after spending so much time in the heat and the rocks for years, and from being in Idaho and then coming down to Grand Canyon, you're going from green lush to just nothing but rocks and heat and no place to, garden or anything. And here is a little tiny little place that had water that managed to be in a bowl that didn't drain it into the rocks. It had a little pond. So.
Cool. Very cool. This isn't Spring Canyon. No, it's not, because that's way up above 205. This is around 213. So there is a side canyon that comes in from the left there that's got water flowing in it, but you're not in a side canyon. You're up on a hillside, huh?
Yeah, I'm way up on a cliffside.
Let's see where
it's
that
just
is.
A
I'm thinking
bunch
about
of
that.
Rubble that okay. came down. So if you're ever, you know, if you have the opportunity or you do to go by that campsite and look up on your right, three quarters of the way up the rock slide, see if it's still there. There's that I recollect. I may have gone up a canyon there. I think there's also at that campsite, there was a, there was a name for it when they take the cactus and they pile it up as stones and they build a fire of the Indians.
A roasting pit. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a roasting pit.
Agave roasting pit. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
There's one of those right there.
It's almost like this is up 214 mile. There's a side canyon. You can go way up this side canyon. There's a stock trail that goes up through some dry fall areas in the Redwall. And there's a spring up there called Shanley Spring. And it's it's interesting.
I've been up that canyon when we camped there, and that wasn't often that we camped there, but this particular time, there were a lot of rattlesnakes at that camp. I remember hopping rock top to rock top and listening to the buzz of the rattlesnakes.
Okay.
It was like, man, this place is full of them, man. Oh. And Wesley Smith, on this particular time I'm talking about, he was really good at extracting rattlesnakes. And he came down to me and said, oh, we found another rattlesnake. And I think he had a little snake catcher thing, or I don't know if he did it on his own or what he did, but he was really good at getting rid of rattlesnakes at the camps.
What else do you remember about Wesley?
What do I remember about Wesley?
Yeah.
I did a lot of trips with Wesley, and Wesley was a one-of-a-kind miracle of a guy. He was like, if I wax poetically about my little pond, Wesley was the human condition of that little pond, with all sorts of surprises and spirit. And Wesley was wild. He had a great touch with the older people on the river trips. You know, not that anybody abandoned the old people on river trips, but we always looked after them. But Wesley was the kind of guy that would sense happiness, sadness, anything in a person, and comfort them and talk to them, pay attention to them, help them, whether it was like a couple that was old figuring out how to set a tent up or where should we sleep or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Wesley was always the right-hand man to help anybody, and just a miraculous. I can't say enough about the spirit that he had. He was just a wild character when he drank. It was like, I don't know how much Indian was in him, but there was some. And he had spent, this could almost go back to what we talked about with the Vietnam vets. And he was in Vietnam, and he was the only man left in the platoon or whatever he was a part of over there. He didn't like to talk about it. And just like anybody in war, from our parents or whatever, they don't want to talk about it. But
right,
he had to in battle and war. My brother was over there, so I am sort of intimate. I didn't have to go, but the guys that had to go out on these nighttime walks and do perimeter rounds, God, they just don't come back. Mm-hmm. And Wesley had to do that as the head of his platoon and so forth. He'd have to lead them, keep them as safe as possible. He had a knack like a native Indian, you know, figuring out where the cavalry's going or whatever. He had a knack for getting people in and out safely, when to stop, what to listen for. So he had been through such a hard life at a young age in war, and he lost all the men in his group, and he just saw things that we don't ever want to have to see. And he, the best thing, like when my brother, that picture you have of my brother was after he had come back from Vietnam, but he didn't have to, at least he didn't talk about it, any of the killing and all that stuff. But Wesley was, again, another one of those Vietnam vets that the Grand Canyon could really put a blanket around and comfort them. Hmm. And it was just like so wonderful. I watched it in my brother, and he talked about it until he finally passed away. But he would talk about going on the Grand Canyon river trips with me, private trips with me. And he, one after another, he would thank me from out of nowhere. And he would just say, you know, you just grounded me from what I've been through. And I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for showing me that there's still beauty and there's still, I can get my mental health back and right. on and on and on. Right. And Wesley was a guy that was out in the water. And that was the underneath of him, as well as just this poetic guy. I was just a great guy. Hmm. I can't talk enough. You know, I could cry losing him, but he was a great guy, fun. And rode his boats, did his job, loved to cook, loved to hang out with the passengers, tell stories, and a great guy. You know, that was Wesley.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So I was lucky to have gotten to do all those trips with him. I did a lot of trips with him, probably from the beginning of his training.
Okay.
So anyway, that's Wesley.
And then we're kind of working toward 1983, but I don't want to start that today because that's going to be a little while going through that. So you worked for M&A in the mid-70s, and then the funding kind of started closing down for that because the studies were done. Well, studies for the time being. Then did you go back and work for another company? Did you go back to work for Arta, or what? How did that work out?
Yeah, I got a call. Let's see. I did. We got done with that. I went to school. I got done with M&A, and that gave me an opportunity to go to school at NAU. And I talked about Herman Bleibtreu giving me a place to stay for all that time and then suggesting that I go back to school and get ready for the rest of your life. You won't be leaving what you love with the canyon and all that stuff, but I'm giving you an opportunity to have a place to stay, you and your girlfriend, no charge, and you can stay as long as you need to. And if I were you, I would enlist over at the university and do something you want to do there. And you got an opportunity now. It's going to be free. So that's what I did, is I went over and got a trade down. And as a machinist, and I had always been around so much metal and frame building for the boats and trailers and things that needed welding or machine work done on them. So I had always wanted to do that, and that's what I did. And I went through an engineering classes for 3 years at NAU and came out as a machinist. And from this gets back to what your question was. And then I got a job at W.L. Gore as a machinist in their medical side of their business. And so the next 2 years after getting out of NAU, I went over and got a job as a machinist, and then I got a point a couple years later that I decided I wanted to go back in the canyon, and I called up my off-and-on girlfriend who owned half of the business, Azra, and so I called up Jessica, and I said, the season's starting. Can you write me into the season, and I'll... I want to go back and row for a while. She goes, yeah, I can put you on and you can start tomorrow if you wanted. And but anyway, it was like I got out of the Museum of Northern Arizona, and then I had really wanted, which they may have kind of done, but somebody did it. I had all the gear and I've been through so much research stuff with those guys and everything. I was hoping they would get the initiative through Carruthers and everybody that ran M&A, get a permit with the Park Service, and I'll stay on as an employee running your research trips and people that come to, for a visit to Flagstaff and the museum and an opportunity to go down the Grand Canyon and all this other stuff. And I thought that that was going to happen, and I thought I would stay at M&A and run all that, and there, it would be profitable, and that I'd make a living out of it instead of commercial river running and stuff. But it didn't happen. It was either lost somehow. Nobody pushed it enough. I wasn't the person that could, with any seriousness, push it. It had to have been where they could see where the money and the value was in it.
Right.
But it was let go. So that's what kind of said, okay, that's not going to happen. And that's put me in school. And then it got me the job at W.L. Gore and got me all over the place doing that work.
And then did you quit Gore to go back to the river then? Or did they give you your summer off? Or how'd that work?
No. I had taken advantage of the great job working at Gore. They gave me sabbaticals when I wanted them. So I hopped on my motorcycle and went all over the Southwest and the West out to the ocean and blah, 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 and camped out off my bike and saw places that I wouldn't typically have gotten to because gas would have been a car running around. It was too expensive. So that motorcycle and I got my sabbatical, and I said, I'm going to be gone for a month and a half or so, and I'll let you know when I'm coming back. And off I went. And then I made a decision in a phone booth in L.A. My way back, and I was at the phone booth in a very stark situation, and I had a freeway to take, either go left and go to Flagstaff or go right and go keep on going down to the border with Mexico, and called up Emmett, called up Gore, and I said, I'm coming back to you guys, and it was also a trip to find out if I wanted to stay at Gore, because they were making some changes there, management-wise, and I was kind of going, you know, I don't know if I should be working here or whatever I should do, I don't know, and so I called them, and I said, I don't want to work on day shift anymore. I was on night shift as a supervisor. I didn't want to work on nights as a supervisor anymore. I wanted to go to days. And I would come back, and I'll guarantee you that I'll be there for X number of months. And after a while, I was ready to leave Gore again. And it was a great place. I made a lot of great contacts. They were really good to me. But I wanted to go back on the river, so I told them I'd be out of there, you know, in X number of weeks. And that's when I got booked for all these trips and started back in the canyon. And it was a good decision. I got to do many, many, many things, and came back to the canyon.
And
it was
Azra that would have been around 1980.
That would have been latter 70s, early. The floods hadn't happened yet, so
right.
It would have been latter 70s and
early 80s. Okay.
Yeah, and maybe a season or two into the 80s, probably, you know, because I was just the other day trying to think, well, how did I, if I left all that and moved to Santa Cruz, but I was rowing on in 83 all the way to 87. So I, what had happened to me is, I worked for Azra, but I had wanted to get out. I moved to Santa Cruz, still went back for the season in the Grand Canyon.
Hang on a second. Wait a minute. I'm trying to dance around 83, but I'm also curious about Santa Cruz. When did you first get to Santa Cruz and get attracted to that place?
Well, as a growing up kid, my family would go there.
Ah,
and,
okay.
And also, I had always been in love with the idea of surfing. And a family with a big, you know, standard 1960 station wagon, a friend of mine, they said, hey, we're going to go to Santa Cruz. along with my family doing this to me, but they said, come on. And then my friend says, you know, we could rent surfboards in Santa Cruz. Let's go. We're going. And so we went there and rented surfboards there, got a taste of it. But my whole life, I had, before river running broke into it, I had always wanted to get to a place, which was Santa Cruz, where there was surf, and I was just mesmerized by the magazines and the movies about it all. Hmm. Never forgot what that was about to me. But river running came in, and I, my friends, the Dubois, were heavily in it, running fun trips up on the Stanislaus South Fork, Tuolumne, not the Tuolumne quite yet, but anyway. And they grabbed me because we were spelunking friends. And they said, you know, how would you like to start rowing boats? We're going on trips every weekend. And that's what took me to the river and put me to where we are now with you.
So Santa Cruz had to wait a while.
So it waited. And I knew that when I said, well, yeah, that sounds fun. And it was, you know, it opened up so much for me to be on rivers. And I adapted to it well. I was good at it. And it, I just fit perfectly for the whole river scene. Okay. And so here we are back at M&A, and I finally am out of that. I'm going to school. I'm working at Gore. And I finally left that, and I went over to Azra. They set me up for the season.
So let me ask you, Scott, I'm going to jump in here. Azra, the company, came from Arda.
Right.
And can you talk anything about that transition? Do you know anything about it, or when kind of did it happen?
You know, all I know, and I don't recollect so much about that, but it always was kind of like odd to me, and you described probably what went on, but to me it was like, oh, we're not Arda anymore, we're Azra. Oh, I wonder what's going on with that, you know? And to my knowledge and recollection, I don't remember much stuff changing. Before I went to Azra, and it was Arda still, I remember Rob Elliott still being around a fair amount. And then, and he was married to Jessica for a while. And then Jessica had the company. I don't know if they shared it with Rob or how that worked, but it didn't seem like too much changed, really, from Arda to Azra. And we had talked about that. So also, right around the time, the oar power boats were going to come into play heavily and out with the motor rigs. So it was kind of a, you know, a political, you know, difficult time. Probably the unknown in the future was always up in the air, of which some of that M&A work in the canyon was about justifying more people down there and motor rigs and what damage do motor rigs do and all the people that are on the motor rigs and on and on and on. So that's, you know, I can't really, I recollect too much changed. And
okay.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
And then one other question I wanted to ask you. There was a study that was done, and I don't know if you were on these trips or even if you heard of them, a rowing trip left Lee's Ferry and arrived at Shinamu in, I don't know, 7 days or five, 6 days, whatever the rowing to Shinamu was at the time. Just about the time, a much faster motorboat showed up. And everybody pulled in together, and all of the commercial passengers changed trips. So the rowing trip took the motor people, and the motor people and the rowing people got on the motorboat, and the motorboat took off and was out of the canyon in a couple more days, and the motor people who had gotten there pretty fast suddenly had to go on these slow pokey oar boats. And did you get in on that at all?
I don't even know of anything like that ever happening.
Okay.
It's a kind of a creative idea, but
yeah, it was written up. There was quite a study written up about it. I think it actually might have been Azra that was doing it. I'm not sure, but anyway, I just wondered if you'd actually got on those trips.
You know, I was just going to say, if anybody was going to do that, Azra would have done that, because that's what put me on dories, rowing dories, so that they could say, you know, come on this trip, and we're providing also an opportunity to go back and forth on our dories that are on it, predominantly rafting, but there's a dory on it, and then there's paddle boats on it, and then they're always trying to, not a gimmick, but trying to mix it up down there. And I wouldn't be surprised that they were doing something like that.
Okay.
Because you did the interchange at Phantom, motor rigs, or people hiked in at Phantom. I mean, that was another,
right,
you know, kind of trip that went on. And I always kind of hated, it was much, much better to have full distance trips with the same people, which was how it started with me.
Ah, why was the exchange, I think of it as a bump in the road. Why was that?
It's because you had people that knew the routine. You were a family at that point by the time you gotten more than, I always figured the people broke down on a river trip. After about 4 to 5 weeks is when the people finally left their computer. Well, they didn't have computers then, but they finally left their jobs in New York or L.A. or wherever, and they were starting to break down and wear down and wear themselves out, be bruised, scraped up, and get used to what it was like to just be away from that life. And now you're being taken care of, and you're being shown hikes and thunderstorms and flooding and cooking on fires, bonfires at night, on and on. So you had people that were broken in, and it wasn't for our convenience, but it was like you had people that finally gave in to what was going on. Hmm. Their spirit finally allowed to be free. And that was always remarkable. And there's not a guide that wouldn't, you know, that's intuitive at all, that could see the breakdown in the people. And that's when the trip became a family. And that's what you needed. And I had talked about, I think I talked about flipping the dory in Crystal. And luckily, because we had people that were used to all sorts of stuff happening on river trips, they were all game to get lines out to flip boats and pull and do all this stuff and that they would never normally do, but we were a family and we needed everybody's help. And once you had them broken in, they were your family to help, whether it's carrying gear, doing this or that, helping push boats in that were too high up on the sand. It was very important to have the trip turn into a family that was with you, not against you.
And did they help in the kitchen, and did they help load and unload the boats and stuff? Or
all that stuff, for sure.
Huh.
Yeah, that was something that I watched Be Creative, and I was kind of going, oh, man, we shouldn't start the trip this way. But some people, some guides would be leading their trip, and they would say, you know, this is our safety talk, and also you're going to help on getting the bags onto the boats and off, and getting, you know, stuff, the food off the boats, and help set this up, and on and on. And I go, oh, they haven't even gotten on a boat or gone down the river yet. Hmm. So I would have brought that in slower, but some head boatmen just decided to lay it on them, but, as if they were afraid they weren't, but there's no way people weren't going to help in the kitchen, and they were going to help lugging stuff off the boats, help on getting their bags at the right time to the landing spot of the boat so we could rig and on. But people were, I always expected them to help and not presented it in a, like, you're on a vacation, but you're going to help and, you know, be mean about it. They just wanted to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to row. They get to row boats, and they get to do all this stuff. And we offered, you know, this is a good rapid at Hermit. If you want to jump off the bow of the boat, we'll pick you up when we get to the bottom, and it'll give you an idea of what the power of a rapid is.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So we gave them a lot, and
cool.
They were always happy to.
So then that join. Exchange at Phantom would break that family up.
Absolutely, and it did. Okay. We had to start all over again.
Huh.
And the people that were leaving, we were sad to see leave, and they were sad that, God, we should have done the full trip. We'll come back another time and finish it, you know. But, man, that moment is gone. And
Then you mentioned the Dorys. There was a trip. There was another company called Grand Canyon Dorys. And they were running all dories with a couple of baggage boats, with rubber boats. But it sounds like what Azra was doing was they would bring one or maybe two dories and the rest were rafts? One dory. Okay.
One dory and the rest rafts.
Okay.
Oh, and then they threw in paddle boats. That was the next thing. So you had a dory, you signed up to be on paddle boats. I think it was advertised like that.
Okay.
Maybe you checked a box that says, we will prefer paddling, because a lot of people, not a lot, but people didn't like the idea of being rowed around on a vacation trip. They wanted to paddle. They wanted to be a part of it.
Okay.
They weren't going to be rowers necessarily,
right?
Ever, unless somebody got hurt and they were capable finally after all the time down there. But yeah, Azra threw the dory out. Which I was happy to. I advocated for the dory because I wanted to see what it's like to run one of those.
How did you decide who would get to be on the boat? I mean, if you only got one and you've got a trip, I don't know, 20 people or so, you know, it's like, well, who gets to ride on the thing today? How'd you figure that out?
They sorted that out. Yeah, they sorted that out. And nobody could. Just like people picking a boatman in a boat to go. Nobody got to hang with me the whole time or or Wesley the whole time.
Right.
We made people switch
move around.
You know,
uh-huh. Good.
Move around.
Yeah.
You know, see what somebody else is like. And, mm-hmm. and it's true. Everybody was different. And some people, some boatmen were good at this and not so good at that. And it was good to mix it all up. So everybody got to taste what everyone was about.
Okay.
And also you got to meet people and get to talk to them.
Right.
You're on the boat for so long and during the day. So, and you got to learn a lot about the people and they learn about you and you get to point different stuff out to the people and talk about the canyon and geology and the faults and a good hike we're going to do tomorrow that's going to be like what we're seeing here and blah, blah, blah. So, you just, by splitting the trip up, you just ruined the cohesiveness of everybody, and it was sad to see him go. And I don't think anybody, very few, but there are people that were ready to get off the river, and they couldn't have gotten off quick enough because it just wasn't their thing.
Huh.
And some of those people thought it was like they were on an ocean liner cruise. They were on some other, you know, hotshot, pricey vacation. We were not ever that, you know. It was like, we need help in the kitchen. Who wants to help in the kitchen, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And the porta potties got to get taken down. Probably we didn't make them do that, but it was like everybody had to pitch in. And some people, very few, but certain states would have people that I thought, if I found out that they were from so-and-so state, I would just go, oh, no, those people, they're too in the middle of the country. They don't know what's going on.
Mm.
They're not going to, you know. So there were times, not often, but, yes, you learned a lot about people. I'll tell you that.
Cool.
And I think I've lost some of the track I was. Oh, well, let me finish one thing, okay?
Yeah.
And you know, how did I get to Santa Cruz and what happened with all that? And I left the full-time river running to just get booked a certain amount. And I wanted to spend my time in Santa Cruz because it was the right time for me to learn how to surf and leave the river running, or at least move out of Flagstaff in the area and get myself written out of the schedule. And and I wanted to study music, which had a good program at the community college in Santa Cruz. They had a great reputation there. And at this point, I was getting bored with what was going on in the canyon, and I felt like I had more to do in my life outside of the canyon than being down there all the time. And when you're there all the time, it's like, it's not that it gets monotonous, but you go, God, I'm just spending so much time down here, but the whole world is going on that I don't find out or I don't know anything. And it's moving forward, and I'm not moving forward down here. And so, and at the same time, what happened to me is that I wanted to pick up a musical instrument. So Jessica of Azra knew that I was interested in music, and I was looking for this and that, and she happened to be at a garage sale and found a saxophone. She knocked on my trailer door and said, "Hey, I found a saxophone at a garage sale. Should we get it?" And I said, "Wow, yeah, get it. Or let's go and get it. That sounds great." And so, not knowing anything about saxophone, but I had studied piano or had lessons in piano as a youngster and could read music and so forth. And got the saxophone, and I started, and I had a good musical ear. I always knew that I had a good ear musically. And so I started to play it. I went to one instructor in Flagstaff, and I said, "All I want you to do is give me a sheet to do the fingering on this instrument and maybe a few basics about this and that, but I don't want you to do any teaching. I just need to get a piece of paper that shows where the fingerings are for all these notes." And he did that, and I went home to my trailer and played and played and played and played and played and played and found people that were river people that I knew and guitarists always, and I would jam with them and play with them, all learning on my own and figuring the instrument out on my own. And it came to the point where I'm going to go to the music school in Santa Cruz, and I'm going to learn how to surf. And I've got a place to stay now that I, from a boatman's family that had a house there. So I could go there cheaply, enter my music classes and take every course that I could take there and surf in the morning, surf in the evening or whatever. But I had music classes at night. I had music classes all day long. The time I had was early morning to go and surf, and I had some friends there that surfed. And so I spent the rest of my life to this point here in Santa Cruz of studying and playing saxophone and surfing, and it took the place. It was water, and it was powerful, and it was something, you know, like when you drop into a hermit, and you do that big drop, and you go up that big steep wall, and you go right through that top razor of the mountain of water that comes back from the top and collapses on you. Well, that's a little taste of also at I can't think of the name of that rapid. Anyway, there were spots in the Grand Canyon where you go through the rapids that are really very similar to a wave. It doesn't act like an ocean wave, but when you see it, it's glassy and it's got a lip to it. And it's just, it wasn't that I wanted that river stuff to happen in the ocean, because it's not at all close really. But it was, I got to Santa Cruz, I moved everything out of Flag, sold my trailer to Larry Stevens, and that helped him out, helped me out. I got rid of a lot of stuff, moved into Santa Cruz, got all my classes set up. Everything you can think of in music, I studied theory, and I studied ear training, and I studied all this stuff, and saxophone, and playing in bands, and writing music. And I did all that to the point where I was capable of joining bands. I'm in bands right now playing.
Cool.
Making some money off of that, being in some really great situations playing for a lot of people. And so that's what happened, is
cool.
That the canyon got to be kind of repetitive to me. And I think I mentioned this earlier, is that Kenton Grua, I talked to him at Havasu one afternoon when we were all there pulled into the mouth at Havasu, and I said, you know, Kenton, I'm thinking about leaving this place, and it's going to happen soon. I'm ready to get out of here. And he just looked at me, and he says, how could you leave this? Mm. Here we are in Havasu. Yeah, it was a gorgeous day. Yeah. And I go, well, it's time for me to move on. And
yeah.
And my other friend, other Dory friend, again, I had his name the other day, but I can't think of it right now. I told him, and he says, yeah, I understand why you're leaving. You know, I thought the same thing, but I just can't get out of it. You know, and that's when you look back, these guys that are in it, it's kind of like the river business traps you in not really expanding because it's such a comfort and it's so, you know, exciting until you get kind of bored of the same excitement. But, you know, a lot of people kind of get stuck in it. And
did you know Kurt Hansen?
Kurt Hansen, I know Whale. I knew Whale.
That's Whale.
Oh, yeah, sure. I knew him, he was with Wilderness World, and a lot of my friends were in Wilderness World. Dennis Silva was from Sacramento area where I was.
Yep. And, Dennis Silva. Yep.
Dennis Silva, and I enjoyed seeing him on the river all the time in the canyon, and since we were from basically the same area in Sacramento, yeah, it was fun. He started out kind of like I did, you know.
Well, I was just thinking about Kurt, and you know, you mentioned sort of the river business can trap you. It can do that, and so yeah.
And Whale, I would see Whale on the water somewhat, but I'd see him in Flagstaff, and he would come over for some reason to M&A, I remember, when I'd be rigging out trips, or he'd come by for some reason, and we'd talk and chat, and yeah, we were friends. And I always felt Whale was captured in the alcohol drug scene but I felt Wilderness World kind of had a temperament in that way. And Azra did too in some way with some of the guides. But he was wrapped up. He went down the rabbit hole of the partying stuff, and it maybe it wasn't what he wanted, but when you're surrounded by people that, you know, are in that trip, you know, in that scene, and you know, I couldn't go up to Whale and say, you know, have you ever thought, you know, like, you know, how are you doing, you know, drug wise or whatever, you know, I didn't ever probe into that, but yeah, there are people that don't make it, and there's the drug world, on land and on the river. And,
right. Well, eventually everybody times out. And then you have to leave. And if you don't have anything set up for that, it can be destroying. I think of Whale, Kurt Hansen in that place.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's and you're in Flagstaff still, and you probably still see the boating community and all this other stuff and you can watch it. I watched it while I was there, but it wasn't because of that. I personally was going, you know, and that's what the M&A, the head of M&A was, he saw the future, and I hadn't seen the future yet.
Right.
And he gave me that door to open.
Opportunity.
What a windfall,
man. Yeah.
Fuck, and he gave me everything. And so if you don't find out on your own, you might, there's a lot of people that found the comfort there. You know, me working in various corporations and stuff, I'd see people that were old, and I'd say, why don't you retire? But when you don't have anything else to do, you don't retire because you don't know anything.
That's right.
And that's how I feel about a lot of the boatmen I was around. I was going, what is going to happen when you join the real world? You don't have a clue. You know, I don't tell them that, but I'm just looking and going, you're so stuck here. You know, you're really stuck in this whole thing. And I think Well, you're afraid to get out of it. You don't want to get out of it because that's the unknown and you're not going to fit in. And you didn't fit in before. I'm not going to fit in now because I spent all these years doing what I want and just taking people down the river and, you know, enjoying life. You know, but you're going to come to the end, and you, if your back's not broken like mine did,
right?
You know,
yeah.
You can't
do
this forever. That's where
eventually we time out. I'm still in pretty good shape, but I'm not going to get a trip because I've irritated some warehouse manager, I've destroyed my hearing or my elbow or my back or you know whatever. One way or the other. Yeah,
it's terrible. It took 2 years to recover on my back injury, maybe 2.5 years, but there was the doctors in Flag that I went to, there were no solutions. Nobody had a solution. And I went through all sorts of x-rays and the other stuff that you get scanned and all that stuff.
Right.
And they said, no, everything looks good. The vertebrae aren't cracked, blah, blah, blah. But the numbness in my legs and being on the river rowing a boat with numbness going on all over your body, and you're going, man, I may not be able to finish this trip out.
Right.
I may not make it anywhere. You know, I can't even do these hikes. And that's when Rob Elliott and I left a camp, and I said to Rob, I said, I can't do it anymore. My leg is numb. I don't have any strength in it. Mm. And my back is really painful. We've got to get to Phantom, and I'm going to helicopter out. I'm done. I'm done for that time period. I said, I'm out of here. You're going to have to fly in somebody else to take over for me. And that was not only a reality check, but that was like, God, you know, what have I done to myself? I'm rowing these heavy boats.
Right.
And I'm doing all this manual labor. You know, it's just constant. And, you know, going down the river, picking up jugs of water and, you know, multi-gallon containers and hauling them up the beach and up and down, and getting gear onto the boat, taking the gear, bending over, pumping the boats, pushing the boats, all this stuff. Yeah, it's tough. And it's a young person's deal, or you can be proud. Well, I'm so old, I'm still doing it. Well, you're not going to be doing too much, you know, when you're finally out of it or you finally break your vertebrae.
That's right. And the pay isn't enough where you can actually,
you
know, 401k or you've got, you know, matching blah, blah. Well, good luck with that.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what, when I got picked to be on the Azra Arda board of whatever they call it, the board of whatever. And I was there to, you know, a boatman's position on things. And I said, my position is, there needs to be some profit sharing somehow in this company. These guys, we're not going to last forever, and you've got to take care of the people that are making you the money. And medical, they're going to need medical. I'm going through that now, that workman's comp. They kind of wanted to fight the workman's comp thing, but I was there to be an advocate for the boatmen because they weren't getting it. And it's all about sending that mule out until it breaks down and you get another mule.
Right.
And you get all these people that are, I want to be able, I want to do, it's so romantic, you know, I want to do this and that. Oh, man. That's the person that takes your place and you're forgotten. I mean, we don't need you anymore.
Right.
We can't use you.
Right. That's right.
Isn't that, I mean, that's harsh, but that's the truth.
Well, it is. I mean, it's interesting because I do remember Dennis Silva telling me one time, he said, you know, I'm sort of God all summer long.
Totally.
And at the end of the season, I go to a restaurant and I order some eggs, and the waitress is yelling at me, I'm not God anymore. You know, and so it's a fascinating, you sort of build yourself up in this position, and then you have nothing really.
Yeah. Really.
And that's still going on today. So it's like,
I can believe it. I can believe it totally.
Yeah.
It's addicting, really.
Yes.
The whole power play, and you think you're somebody down there because people are fawning over you, and you're coming up to lava, and everybody's freaked out, and you're a little nervous yourself, and Crystal, you're a little nervous, and oh man, you know, and the people are excited and nervous, and then all of a sudden it works out, and you're the hero, and oh my God, you're up in the heavens in our mind, you know, thank you so much, blah, 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 blah. And it goes to the wrong person. It goes to their head, their ego, their pride, their stance in life, and who they are in life, and all this stuff. And I'm to this day, there are people that I run into that are family members by coincidence of people that we know mm-hmm. that are actually doing that work in the canyon still. And they still think of themselves as river gods. And they want to keep going back. They don't. They're so blind to what they're believing in and how important they think they are, and on and all the reasons why they're still doing it and all this stuff. But you know, it's crazy. You know, it's a great opportunity, and it's like anything. You got to know the time to get out. And
right.
That's it. You know.
Interesting.
Okay. That put me in Santa Cruz, and I studied nice. Music, and I learned how to surf. And those are the the things that I wanted to do since being a little kid, and that dream never left me.
Lovely.
And I just had to go through the whole river in Grand Canyon, Idaho, floods, all the experiences with people, everything. I got out when it was time to get out, and with no regrets. I didn't leave too soon. I didn't leave too late, and that's an art, to know when to leave. And whatever it is, you know, and certainly when everybody thinks you're a god and you start believing it and you really love the adoration, man, you're too blind.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, yeah.
Excellent.
Well,
Scott, thank you. Thank you so much for this really interesting journey today. Next time I look forward to talking to you about 1983, which was a challenging year, and we'll do that. But today has been a really interesting, I think, journey as well. Does it sound like it's a good place to wrap this up?
Yeah, it's a good place. Yeah, definitely. And I got my little list by me, and we've almost checked out everything.
Okay.
Only thing I want to talk about next time is my Jeff Aronson and I did a very intense hike before the 83 season.
Okay.
And I'll lead into the 83 talk with our death-defying journey that led us both into what we didn't know was in front of us, but the dam was about to break and flood us all. So.
Okay. That sounds great. Well, with that, let's go ahead and conclude part 9 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Scott Imslin. Today is Tuesday, May 30th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's been fun, as usual, fun to go back in time, and it's fun walking through it, and it's my pleasure.
Cool. Okay, hang on.